Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June 11th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening, Cheryl Kulis Howard begins a series entitled Listen, God is Calling. Tonight's session is KHC 2001-01 and is entitled Called into the World. Let's listen in.
So we'll go ahead and begin. My name is Cheryl Kulis Howard, and I'm really grateful to be back in the village again, and especially grateful to have a chance to try to make sense of a six-month journey that I took with a friend from September last year till March this year that took us literally around the world. We didn't intend to be doing that initially. My friend Sarah, that I went to college with, we spent a year together in college, and then I lost track of her for 15 years until we were both here at Holden. She lived at Holden from 92 to 95, and we passed each other in the hallway up in the hotel, and You know how you pass somebody and you think that couldn't be. Uh-huh. And so we turned around at the same time and went, are you kidding? Is that you, Sarah? So we reunited at that time, and then I asked her if she would come along as the nurse on a team that I took to East Africa, Tanzania, in 1999 as a part of Trinity Lutheran College, 3 weeks. African immersion experience. During that time, Sarah and I lived in a treehouse in a coffee plantation in Tanzania, and learned that we were pretty compatible as traveling companions. So we dreamed that in the in-between years, when I'm not taking a group to Tanzania, that maybe we would get a dream team of women together and teach at the Maasai Girls Lutheran Secondary School in the even year, which was the year 2000. And so we came back with that idea. And then it was April 1st, just last year, that I met Sarah, and she said, you know, I found out I can be gone from my job for 6 months. And so we started thinking about what would we do with 6 months. And I was in between relationships and jobs and all. So we laid that in the Lord's hands and started with Africa. But she began to talk about India. And so I had some connections, friends that are from India and had invitations to India before. And about the same time, we found out we could get an around-the-world ticket, air ticket, for less than $1,600. So all of that kind of rolled together and unfolded, and not even all the way unfolded. It was unfolding as we were on the journey. But basically, the journey was a month in Europe, visiting the Iona community and Teze community in Scotland and then in France, and then a whirlwind trip around Europe on Eurail, and then to East Africa, back to the Maasai Girls School for a month, then almost 2 months in India, about 2 weeks in Nepal, 2 weeks in Thailand, a week in Malaysia, about half a week in Singapore, almost 2 weeks in Indonesia, 4 days in Hong Kong, and back home. So that's where we're going to go in the next couple of minutes, if you're ready to take the trip. Can I have somebody turn the lights on? Sarah and I did not talk much about what we were going to take with. We both had traveled a bit, and so as long as we had the visas that we needed and the passport, we were off and running. And I never really said this to Sarah, but I was kind of thinking when I got tired of wearing my clothes, I'd wear hers. But Sarah is the one that's dressed identically to me on the day we left on the trip. And so we actually were taken as people that worked at the information booth when we arrived at Westminster Cathedral on Sunday morning. She was handing out brochures. If you know Sarah Daniel, you can imagine. Oh, yeah, I saw them somewhere. Oh, sure, you can take a tour at such and such a time. She was just running the show there. So we stayed with a woman that Sarah hiked with here at the village sometime in the 90s. She still had Julie's address. And sure, come and stay with us in London. So most of the way on this whole trip, we stayed with some close or even remote connection that we had. So this was a hiking buddy that we stayed with in London. And then we headed up through London by train. And getting to Iona is somewhat like getting to Holden Village. You take a train up to Glasgow and to a smaller community called Oban, and then you take a 45-minute ferry ride across to the Ross of Mull, the Isle of Mull, and then you take an hour bus ride to the other end of there, and then there's a 5-minute little ferry that takes you to this tiny island of Iona. You can see on the far right the large building. No, it's not on the far right. It's this building right here is the Abbey at Iona. Tomorrow we'll spend some more time and look at more pictures of the Iona community. But this is part of the worship setting, the transept. So you get a sense of how old it is. And the Iona community, it bases itself, the people that are committed to the community, commit themselves to daily prayer and scripture reading, and to be accountable to their use of time and money, and they are also involved in peace and justice work. Those are the commitments that they make in this community. In the center of the week, participants need to take a pilgrimage around the island, and also a pilgrimage around their lives. As we reflected on the crossroads and the journeys of our lives, the decisions that we've made, the stormy places, the places of death, the places of new life, the places, the high places where we could see where we'd come from and maybe even see where we were going. So that was a real precious centerpiece for the time in Iona. From Iona, we took about 8 days to really whirlwind it around Europe. This is Edinburgh, Scotland. From there, we went south by train, took the Channel train, and ended up in Paris that night. And again, for the 8 days, we slept on the train and woke up in another city or even another country. So from Paris, we woke up the next morning in Barcelona, Spain. Took the train again and spent a day in Milan. And the next day, we knew that the Pope had an audience on Wednesday morning. So we found ourselves with the Pope there at St. Peter's Square and had a day roaming around Rome. Here's the Colosseum. From there, the train took us to Sicily. This is a beach on Sicily. And then we headed back up north to Venice. And then west again to south France, south central France, and the Taizé community. Some of you are familiar with that name, Taizé. Maybe because at your churches there are chants, some music that you might sing, Ubi Caritas, or Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Those might be familiar to you. You see at the top of this building a bunch of bells, carillons, that played to call us to worship. They played for maybe 5 minutes, 6-7 minutes, and they called us to worship 3 times a day. The progression of the weekend at Taizé, they like you to come on at the beginning of the weekend, stay for a week, and It usually takes, I think, a week before, at least for me, before I could be still enough inside and involved enough in the pattern of worship three times a day, before breakfast, before lunch, and then after dinner, an hour or hour and a half, 2 hours, in this incredible setting for worship. I counted some 175 candles in the various places up across the top. What you see in the center there is where the brothers, some 150 men that have committed themselves to the Teze community, ecumenical people from around the world. And they will be ushered in before worship and kneel or sort of squat, sit on these small benches. And then people will be on either side and into many buildings out the back. So when we were there, there were maybe 600 people in the community. In the summertime, there's maybe 6,000 or up to 10,000 people. How on earth do they do that? Would be a reasonable question. It's amazingly organized, and I was talking to Richard. He's going to be taking a group to Teze this summer, and they have just made a rule that groups that go to Teze can take one person over 30 for every five people that are under 30. So Teze is really focused on welcoming the younger pilgrim, one who is seeking God in their lives. And that's really what their focus is. One of the brothers leads a group of people. These are the people that are over 30 in Bible study each morning, in at least three languages. So he would speak a paragraph in French, and then he'd flip over to German, and then he'd speak in English. And sometimes he'd tell a joke, and the French would laugh, and then the Germans would laugh, and then we'd get it in English. And it was most amazing. And then we were set into small groups of same language, so we could discuss and apply to our lives the principles that had come forth from the Bible study in the morning. This tent is also where we gathered for meals. Army rations comes to mind when I think about the food at Teze. Very adequate, but nothing to write home about. Or depends on what you want your people at home to hear. Lots of number 10 cans of peas and carrots. And then for dinner, a pea and carrot casserole of sorts. Not nearly as creative as the cooking here in Holden. From Teze, we took the train through Switzerland and up to Germany to visit one of the students that I had in youth group who'd married a German man. And then we were on to Nairobi, and then to ground transportation to Kilimanjaro International Airport and Arusha, and then the Maasai Girls School. So this is Mount Kilimanjaro on the southern Kenya, northern Tanzania border. And here are women that have wormed their way into my heart and life. I would gift everyone I know with a chance to hear these young women sing. These are primarily Maasai girls. Mostly they come to the school maybe around age 12, 13, 14 years old. Maybe they're older. They are the brightest and best from their primary school. They call it Standard 7. So they have passed elementary school, maybe to seventh grade, something like that. They speak their native tongue, mostly Maasai, but they also speak Swahili, and they've learned enough English to be getting by, kind of like my high school Spanish. So these girls, when we first meet them, when they first come to the school, they're not too eager to try their English, but they will. Kind of like I'm not too eager to talk Spanish to anybody, but I will if I have to. The school is taught in English, and when they have their red sweatshirts and their either khaki skirts or their plaid skirts on, then they're supposed to speak in English, but you can imagine how that goes. Their academic work is really tough. They mostly don't have books, but they do have paper and pencils, and so they're taught with the British system, and it's a lot of oral tradition for them, and a lot of memorizing verbatim, the stuff that gets written on the board. So it's not a very interesting way to learn, but they are trained and they go to school to be able to pass the national exam. And when we bring groups there, we add a little variety to their learning. And when we go, like I will this coming November, with another group from Trinity Lutheran College, we'll split up into groups of six or seven and do Bible studies with them and just do conversational English. And even just in 8 days of being with them, 10 days or so, they begin to be more comfortable with the language and more comfortable at the school. And it's fun to watch them just flourish. These young women, if they don't get to go to school, will be, most of them, married by arrangement by the age of 12 or 13, 14. And although it's illegal in Tanzania, most of them will still be circumcised around the time of their, or just before their marriage. That is beginning to change, however. When I was there in 1997, I talked to some girls about circumcision, not wanting to project my own disdain, if you will, about that particular tradition and ritual. They said, if we're, in 97 they told me, we want to be circumcised. It is a rite of passage. It means we've become a woman. And I spoke again in 99 with some other students, and they looked away from me, looked down, and said, if we're not circumcised, we will be ostracized from our village. That was their understanding. I went to the kind of the dorm mom, Coco Nasarian is her name, and I said, what's the deal with female circumcision? And she said, well, even some of the girls don't know this, but you don't change that tradition, you know, because somebody decides all of a sudden, let's not do this anymore, because it's deeply rooted in their culture. But they also are realizing that for a number of women, it means infection, it means mutilation, it might mean infertility, etc. And so the moms are also not wanting this to be the case for their daughters. So what they do is throw the circumcision party, invite all the friends and relatives, kill the goat, do the celebration, bring the girl into the hut where she would be circumcised, and then Coco Nasarian told me, then we buy off the old lady, you know, the grandma that would do the circumcision, we give her money instead. The girl isn't circumcised. They hope that the guy doesn't know what she looks like anyway. And then so the circumcision doesn't happen, but they all pretend. So that's how traditions gradually get first confronted and gradually changed. In September, the rains hadn't happened really at the right time, so the harvest didn't happen. And there was no running water at the girls' school from September until we left in late November. So for several weeks, water was trucked in, and the girls would get a bucket of water with which to wash themselves and wash their clothes and wash the stuff around the school, the cement sidewalks, etc. A very hardworking young adult, incredible spirit about these women, and a great privilege to be able to be with them. Here's Jean Wallstrom, former board member of Holden Village, who is currently the chaplain and assistant to the head matron there. She's handing out their first Bible. They're getting Bibles there in Swahili. And so we teach in Swahili and in English. Typical Maasai women, two generations there. Lots of story, lots of life you can see on their faces. I actually took this picture. I was in search of a young woman that I'd met 5 years ago who was at the girls' school. She made it through Form 4 and then got pregnant and needed to leave the school and is somewhere on the Tanzania-Kenya border. I heard that she was in this community, and so I went and asked if they knew Esther Musheni, and I knew she was ready to deliver her baby. Was it a boy or a girl? And every time I asked a question, the answer was yes. Is Esther here? Yes. Did she have a boy? Yes. Did she have a girl? Yes. So I don't know if Esther is even there, but we try. I just love that look on her face. So are you going to buy my bananas or aren't you? That is actually taken from inside a truck in the community of Arusha. From here, we went back through Nairobi and visited with a mission family there. And then we flew to Bombay. I'd never been to India before, and by this time in the trip, we've been gone 2 months, we found ourselves profoundly open to all sorts of things, and knowing that we were in new territory. Sarah and I had been to Europe before, we'd been to East Africa, and now we were experiencing brand new ways of thinking and perceiving. And in earlier conversation in Mike's class, we talked about cultural diversity and how people do things for different reasons, and talked about how we worship 1 hour a week. And for these folks and for the rest of the time on my journey, I was surrounded by worship at all times of the day and night. These women are stringing beautiful flowers together to wear in their hair and also to adorn the many gods that are all over the place. On your way to work, you'll stop by a place like this, and you can buy some sandalwood paste from this guy and put sandalwood paste on this god's face, and you can offer the flowers or maybe incense or a variety of things. But worship was absolutely everywhere. And yes, the cow is sacred. We saw cows everywhere, and the median in between six lanes going both ways. Cows would stop traffic. Here, cows eating dinner, I guess. As in most of these pictures, these were shots that I could take without feeling like I was intruding. The picture that I will hold forever in my heart is the picture I didn't take that's taking place 3 feet from here. There are several people in a pile of garbage, much like this, finding things that they could possibly sell. They're finding food for their families. They're eating from piles like this. That was the beginning of a taste of India. Both the hunger issues, the begging, that was constant, and also the garbage everywhere. I never really got to have a conversation with anyone about it. It didn't make sense, but I come from, I mean, the glasses I wear have everything to do with recycling, and it wouldn't occur to me to drop really anything on the ground, and I watched businessmen on trains finish whatever it was they were eating and just throw the stuff out the window. And so India has an incredible garbage population, and I don't know if it has to do with a caste system where if you throw the food out, someone else can eat it, or someone else will clean it up because it's their job. Or, I mean, I don't know. I come away from this trip with all kinds of questions, many more questions than I have answers. And lots of times when you travel and try to be as close to the people as we tried to be, still there are things you just can't talk about. You can't get information. Like is true here. In the United States, there's stuff that we just assume people not know about the United States, but it's there for all to see. Where we lived was with the woman in blue there, Ida Powell. I'd known her from here in the United States. She's a 65-year-old woman that has lived in this space for 44 years, a place where her husband's family grew up. And there it is that she is surrounded by 25, 30, 35 young Indian kids where she teaches English and teaches some basic living skills there at her preschool in her home. Ida welcomed us with open arms. When I called and said, we're going to be in Bombay, can we come visit? Oh, please come and stay as long as you possibly can. Then she called her son here in Washington and said, I have some girls coming. What on earth should I get them to eat? And he said, well, you're going to need to get them some white sliced bread and get them some luncheon meat. And get them, I mean, he had this list. Well, we got there and she had the sliced bread, etc. And we said, oh, Ida, could we eat chapatis and roti and puri? Will you teach us how to eat? And do we have to eat with silverware? Could we just eat with our fingers like you do? And so for 2 months, we didn't have a knife, fork, spoon in our hands. We ate the food that people of India eat. And it actually was really hard for most people that we visited really all around the world to figure us out, because they assumed, because of the color of our skin, one, that we're rich, which we are by global standards, although we lived on a dollar or two a day for the whole trip. It was hard for them to understand that we were not tourists. We saw ourselves more as travelers and adventurers. And once that barrier was broken down, we were more welcomed into people's lives, and it was holy ground. This is the about 12 hours by train south of Bombay, a state called Goa, a destination of European travelers. It's just a gorgeous place, and the site of one of the best fundraisers I've ever heard of. Here Sarah and I are looking out over just this gorgeous beach area, and all of a sudden this man comes up and sticks a piece of metal in my ear. And I'm startled. It didn't hurt, but I didn't understand what was going on. And I glanced, and he had a lab coat on, and he comes up and announces that my ears are dirty and he's come to clean them. And I didn't doubt that my ears were dirty, I'm not used to having somebody just come and clean them, especially when I didn't ask. And so Soon he produces a card out of his pocket. I'm Dr. So-and-so, and I'll clean your ears. And he'd stick this piece of metal in my ear, and then he'd pull it out and smear the stuff on his the palm of his hand and stick it in, and you know, I don't know if it was magic, sleight of hand, he was getting it from somewhere else, I don't know, but the stuff was pretty gross in there. Anyway, he's wanting then for me to pay 250 rupees per ear, and then if he finds any stones in there, that'll be another 250 rupees. So this is quite a fundraiser for him. He did in fact find a stone. I said, I don't have rocks in my ears. I mean, I'm sure I do a better job of cleaning than that. And he produced a little bottle of wax that he called a stone. And boy, I mean, what can you say to this guy? Thanks, but no thanks, whatever. Put it back. That was part of my hearing mechanism. Anyway, pretty unusual experience there. Another unusual experience was the auto rickshaws that are a major mode of transportation. It's a three-wheeled golf cart-like thing that had sort of handlebars inside and a pulley that, like a lawnmower, you started it up like the lawnmower. And these things would just zip through traffic and take you wherever you wanted to go. This was our first ride in this auto rickshaw. You could reach out the window that wasn't there and touch the buses along the side, or you know, shake hands with the motorcycle guy behind you. A lot of times I had a handkerchief over my nose with aromatherapy stuff because it was incredibly polluted. A lot of exhaust. This guy is taking us to our destination, home for the evening, and all of a sudden we're in a back road, it's rather dark, the machine stops. And Sarah and I just took a deep breath and thought, oh, this feels a little unsafe. The guy jumps out and he reaches behind Sarah, and you know, just, it's all going in slow motion, we're wondering what's going to happen next. He brings out a 1 liter, like a 7-Up bottle that he had gasoline in. Filled up the tank, jumps in, pulls the pulley, we're off and running again. So that was, phew, yeah. The colors of India are just absolutely phenomenal. The saris that they wear, 5 yards of material that they wrap around in these beautiful, beautiful garments that they wear. Just incredible. These are piles of dried red peppers. Most everything was heated to some extent in the culinary department. And you also see the McDonald's sign, and it's a little blurry, but Pond's Cold Cream, you can kind of see that in the upper right corner there. You could, if you had money, you could buy just about anything you might want. People didn't have necessarily a storefront to sell things. This guy is selling water bottles. It looks like that would be really heavy laden, that he'd almost pop a wheelie, but those are actually very light plastic containers that the women carried on their heads or wrapped around their, you know, wrapped their arm around. And they would fill those up and walk them into the gardens and water their gardens that way, or carry water to their homes. Another common mode of transportation. This vehicle isn't nearly as full as it will get, although there's people almost hanging out the windows and people all across the top of the bus. This was a pretty common sight, place where people lived. Just behind me, and soon after I took this picture, was the first time a woman came up to me and in broken English asked if I wanted her little boy, if I would take her little boy home and raise him as my own. That's a really holy moment, especially when you can't talk more about it because there's not a common language, but to begin to deal with the tension of what it means to live in India and maybe not be able to feed all the mouths that one produces, and to hope that someone else will take your child and raise it. Difficult. This is laundry day. A bucket and a rock and a little soap is all you ever need. Whenever we were in the villages, the first time we'd walk through the village, people stayed pretty much out of the streets and kind of watched us. Sarah ran most days and I walked. And it wasn't long before the village kids especially would come out rather timidly at first and pretty soon hanging on us and surrounding us and wanting their pictures taken and repeating whatever we would say in English, wanting to learn English. This is an ashram in South India now that's it's called Sparrow's Nest, and it's run by a Korean pastor. You see Gloria there right below the door, and her husband Joe, who's an Indian man. This ashram is centered in Christ, but half of the people there are Hindu and half Christian. They meet together every morning at sunrise to walk the perimeter of the compound, and then to do some yoga stretching, and then meditation and prayer for their community and for the world. This is a gathering at 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon where the village children come and sing songs and pray and worship and learn a bit more about Jesus and get a little bite to eat. These kids were some of the kids also that I had in informal English classes when they came after school. Another washing scene, not exactly Maytag. This is a place where this Hindu woman offered what's called a puja for us. We climbed a hill above another ashram that we stayed at for the Christmas time, and we went into this really dark room, and she offered there a prayer to several gods, Hindu gods, that were surrounded her for prosperity. She rang bells and lit incense and poured holy water and variety of things. It was really a kind of a loud worship experience in there in an enclosed area. And again, many, many gods that she offered the prayer to on our behalf. This is Christmas Eve. At 9 o'clock on Christmas Eve morning, some 75 village kids came to the ashram, and there we did all kinds of relay races. Here's the gunny sack race, leapfrog race, three-legged race, how to get to the finish line the slowest on a bicycle race. A lot of fun with the kids. And then afterwards, again, we met for prayer and singing and a simple meal. The kids were given prizes of things that they need for school. It was really a great day of celebration. And that night on Christmas Eve, we shared the Eucharist together. And then we learned of a tradition in India that I want to take as my own. We didn't see Christmas trees in India at Christmas time. Instead, they have competitions of making what they call a crib, a place for baby Jesus. And this is maybe 3 feet off the ground. It was built on Christmas Eve of all kinds of sticks, and then they stuck the hay in, and it was lit up. The first time we actually saw it finished was after at midnight, after the worship service. And Sarah and I think we just melted before this scene, because unlike the Christmas tree and all the presents underneath it, you couldn't miss Jesus here. And in many, many a home, we saw the crib that different families had made. And we watched Hindu children pulling baby Jesus out and asking who this is. And you really couldn't miss Jesus here. Again, I mentioned crib competitions. The week before Christmas, many people are making all kinds of renditions of a crib. At a college nearby, here's another crib. Maybe fashioned after the Taj Mahal. You can see baby Jesus in there. You also see some lotus kind of look like cupcake holders, but lotus and the onion domes and the Hindu wheel of life behind there. This stands maybe 10 feet tall. About every 5 seconds it changes colors from inside. Quite a different place for baby Jesus to be born. Now we are again in South India at an orphanage / school. About 300 of these kids are maybe children of people with leprosy, folks that cannot take care of the kids. And so here at this school is a girls' orphanage, and then about half a mile down the road is a place for the boys. And then the other 300 kids come from the villages around the surrounding area. Can somebody tell me what time it is? How much?
It's 7.
7? Okay. Gives me some idea. We'll need to speed up a little bit. At this place, a woman named Mrs. King saw the need of educating the kids and also having a place for them to live. And so she gathered one woman who was a destitute, mother-aged woman, a woman that had been left maybe by her husband, or somehow, I mean, maybe widowed, and then an older woman, like about the age of a grandma. So one grandma, one mom, and maybe 6 to 8 girls, and put them together in a family unit. And so mom cooked, and so the kids had contact with two other generations. And it was a beautiful synergy in this place. They also started a bakery here, so the kids have a slice of bread to eat when they come to school, and the extra bread is taken to a huge hospital nearby where people in the community buy the bread. Also, girls that can't exactly make it academically in this school learn how to sew, and they sew the hospital gowns for the hospital, and sew the school uniforms. So pretty precious place. We worked with the oldest kids in this school setting. Wonderful kids. When I got home, one of the pieces of mail I got, I'm not sure if it was one of these guys, because again, we met so many kids in such a brief period of time. One of the kids wrote and said, in his broken English, "You remember me, I remember you, and I would like to come to America and be your son. My mother and father give pleasure to say it is good for you to come and get me. Bring the visa and the passport. My life is half dead here. My father, how did he say it? My father loves my older brother, but he does not have love for me. He somehow used the word nicely, incorrectly. Something like he beats me nicely with a belt when I go to church." Just a heartbreak kind of letter. And just You know, what do you do with that? More of the tension. Here we have moved on to the community of Madras, and this is actually a gypsy colony that we visited. Sarah was approached by this man and asked if for 25 rupees or, no, 10 rupees or 25 cents, would you buy my baby and take her home to be your child? Again, the filthy water, the living conditions here. It was here that I saw probably the person that looked, of all the people, the one that looked just the oldest, most wrinkled, most, I don't have a picture of her, it wouldn't be appropriate to take the picture, but she also was profoundly downcast, and I asked somebody else in the community, what is her story? And they said, well, her husband's been very, very sick, and there's no chance for any of these people to get medical attention at all. And so the men of the community had just taken her husband out to the wilderness, where they left him to be killed and devoured by the animals. That's what you do. It's time to die. I can't relate to that. I you know, what do you do with that? Before we left, we were approached by a woman who had come from India, sat on the day in our home church, sat on the quilts that were made by the quilters at our church, and said, oh, if someone could come and teach the women in our community whose husbands have leprosy, they're totally ostracized, they can't get work, but we have fabric. If someone could come and help them learn how to make quilts. So I was at Holden in August last year, and I talked to Eileen, and we talked about how to make strip quilts. And I learned that 17 to 20 women were going to show up on this particular day. And originally I heard that we'd have those, what do you call those, foot sewing machines available to us?
Treadle
machines. We didn't have that. And I also actually heard that we would have scissors. And the day of, I still didn't have scissors. So I had a kitchen knife, and I started cutting up fabric. It's like, what are we going to do? Hopefully the needles and thread will show up. What, you know, I'm not a seamstress. If my mom ever knew what I'd done in India, you know, help these people start a cottage industry, she would laugh her head off. But thanks to Eileen and these women that delivered a bunch of fabric, in fact, the scissors did arrive. And in 2 days, we made this queen-size quilt and pillows. The girls just went crazy, stitching all by hand. And then this little guy has kind of a child's blanket that was strip quilt, like you taught us how to do. So, so thank you for that. And yeah, even if you don't know what you're doing, God can use skills that you don't have. We've taken now a 36-hour train ride up to Calcutta. If you have ever wondered about India and maybe not had the chance to go or would rather not, you could go via the book City of Joy. We read it in South India, and it helped us make a lot of sense of what we were seeing. I showed this to a sixth grade elementary school class, and a guy said horse when he saw this, and it is very much like this. The lives of these men to make enough money to get barely enough food for their family that probably lives on the street. He may sleep under that at night. But in the cold, in the heat, barefoot, it's hard to see. It's hard to imagine. This is where many, many, many people live, just on the streets of Calcutta. We lived across the street from the mother house, and visited with the Sisters of Charity, who daily live and work among the poorest of the poor here in Calcutta. We also visited one of the homes for the destitute and dying, Mother Teresa's place. We had a hard time finding our way in, and so we walked around a compound along the railroad tracks, found out that the original door that didn't actually have a door handle and it was rusty and didn't look like it could possibly be an entrance was in fact the entrance. So we walked around, back around this huge compound, and in the meantime, at the place where the railroad tracks were, a group of maybe 25 or 30 people had gathered, and there was a body laying nearby that was covered except for his feet. And just in the couple of minutes that we were gone, a man had died, people had gathered, and someone came up to Sarah and said, my brother has just died, would you like to buy his body? Again, no frame of reference. Is this man a poor man and there's no money to buy a pyre for him to be cremated? Would he just, like in the book, be thrown into the river? Or is he one that maybe they hope they can get some money for his body, and his body would be sent to the United States and used by our medical science as a skeleton to study in our medical schools, because that's where most of the skeletons come from that we study. It's from India. A lot of stuff I didn't know, a lot of stuff I didn't want to know. In that situation, I still don't know what the question meant. People washing, drinking, doing life in India. The women gathering their water at the local water source. And this is now in Delhi, just outside of Delhi. We couldn't imagine going to India for nearly 2 months and not seeing the Taj Mahal, so we made our way also to see this incredible feat of architecture in honor of a bride of a king who'd given birth to 17 children, died giving birth to the 17th. He liked her a lot and made this mausoleum for her. Just amazing. It's made out of marble. At sunrise and sunset, it kind of glows because you can kind of see through it. Just phenomenal. This is a place we stayed. Air-cooled room, attached bath with homely atmosphere. Pseudo English teacher that I am, I went to the front desk and said, in American English, when we want to describe something as really comfortable and a place where you want all the people to come because it's so nice, we say it's homey. And if something is not nice and actually very bad, and I think I even used the word yucky, which of course he didn't mean, I said, we use the word homely. And he said, well, in India we say homely. I thought, fine. And actually this was one of the worst places that we stayed. Pepto-Bismol walls with smeared other stuff on, and anyway, it was adequate. Homely works for this place. From Delhi, we headed up to Kathmandu and were 2 weeks in Nepal. These are the Himalayas. I have to confess that there we stood at the foot of some of the highest mountains in the world, and I felt the same grandeur that I feel here when I'm at Holden Village, surrounded by these incredible mountains, knowing full well that these aren't nearly as tall as the Annapurna Range here outside of a community called Pokhara, about 7 hours by rickety bus west of Kathmandu. Incredible place. Here we are back in Kathmandu. This is Monkey Temple. Buddhist everything. young Buddhist kids with the candles or oil, ghee, they're burning there. A child with a child begging. Worship on the streets, worship everywhere. We took a 30-kilometer bike ride around Kathmandu. Don't do that. It's so polluted, and the bikes are awful. Sometimes the brakes work, and sometimes the gears stay in the right gear, and the traffic is awful, and it wasn't a pleasant day. But we ended our bike ride in this Pashupatinath, it was called, a location where cremations happen day in and day out, year in and year out. The fires that you see burning are cremations. The orange fabric that you see is a body that's going to be placed on that pyre. I still haven't found words to describe what it was like to be here. It made me have to deal with the death in a new way. A royalty person had died that day, and here they're preparing his body for cremation. They're pouring ghee, clarified butter, over his head. His younger son will make one trip around the pyre. They took the flowers off the top and threw them into the river and reached underneath the orange fabric and took another, maybe a prayer cloth that was close to his body, threw that in the river. And then his oldest son, that you can barely see, he's dressed in white, and he will be for the next year. He actually walked around the body three times and then was handed a lit torch and actually lit this on fire, the pyre on fire. Just holy ground. When somebody dies here, it's, you know, they're shuttled off. We don't see any of this. And here it's part of life. Death is part of life. This is Durbar Square or Temple Square in Kathmandu. Incredible people watching place. A bicycle rickshaw. In Nepal, they carry absolutely everything on their backs with some kind of thing attached to their forehead. So this guy is carrying a couch. You can see his hand around the couch, and he has it strapped to his forehead and then on his back. We watched, and I never could get a picture of this, but we watched women come up to a truck that was loaded with bricks with a huge basket on her back, with this strap around her forehead, and watched them dump these bricks, and watched her whole body just lurch with the pressure, the weight of this, and then load that whole thing up and off the ground. Incredibly hardy, hardworking people in Nepal. Gathering water, washing, living in community. This is Joe Albertson's meat department. A large reason why I was a vegetarian on this trip. Again, Kathmandu and the colors and the fabric and the textures. From Kathmandu, we flew to Bangkok. And again, we're in Buddhist land. This is the best I could do of a picture of a laying down Buddha that took up a huge building, the feet of which were inlaid mother of pearl and told the characteristics of the Buddha. Mind-boggling. All of these structures are made out of little chunks of porcelain. Just phenomenal. This is the floating market in Bangkok. For centuries, the people have come to sell their wares in this kind of location. The bridge over the River Kwai. We learned about World War II, went to the Allied cemetery there, and learned about the Death Railway. And this is actually the original bridge is about a half mile up the Kwai River there. Also in western Thailand, we did some kayaking in some limestone caves. And then we made our way down through Malaysia, did some trekking in central Malaysia, and then down to Singapore. This is in Chinatown in Singapore. Again, some of the many Hindu gods. This looks like you'd be able to go in the door there, but this is actually the top third of a huge building. That is a Hindu temple there in Singapore. Singapore is the most antiseptic place I've ever been. The rules, even gum chewing is totally illegal. The back of the train ticket says, if you bring drugs into the country, you die. No questions asked. Very stringent. This is Lutheran Church of Our Redeemer in Singapore. We were there for the 41st year celebration and the dedication of this church building. And I add this here because it represented for me unity and diversity. This is a three-story building. If you could follow that ski ramp looking thing on the top, follow it down the far side of the building, you have a three-story stained glass window that tells the life of Jesus. And then on each of the floors, you can get a little taste of it. There's a worship area up on the first floor, and one up on the third floor, and one on the first floor. And every Sunday morning, there's LBW worship in English, a contemporary worship service, a Tamil Christian from South India, and a Chinese worship service. In this place every Sunday morning. It's not easy for them to make it work, but they do. And we were there again on the night that they celebrated what God is doing there in Singapore. It was a great testimony. The last few pictures are in Indonesia. We spent a couple of weeks there with the Legian Lutheran Church, not Lutheran, but it was Protestant Church in Bali. And we're really challenged by these peoples living out the gospel and living in community with one another, being there for each other. Always travel teaches me and broadens my perspective. We were talking earlier about the colored glasses that we wear. Just incredible. The stories that these kids have to tell, the stories that we in this room have to tell, make of us a community. And that's much to be celebrated. God leads us in all sorts of directions and has been at work in your lives as God was in work in my life to open the doors to be able to make this trip of a lifetime that my friend said, now are you going to do another trip of a lifetime next year? I don't know exactly where the next step is for me, but I do know that God is calling us by name to be in the world, in our homes, in our communities, in our churches, and in the world, to be the light, to be the voice of reconciliation, to bring about the kingdom, to usher in forgiveness, to live lives like Jesus lived. And that's the privilege. These next days, I welcome you to sessions of conversation where I'll tell you some more stories. about the trip, but I selected four topics for this week that have been stirring in me. The whole issue of community and what it means to maybe not have much community here in the Western world and what it's like out there. We'll talk about simplicity one of the days. We'll continue our conversation on cultural diversity. And then one of the days we also will look at the journey inward and how to find that quiet place and some lessons I learned in South India. So welcome and thanks for listening.